welcome to Writer's Blockbusters, the show where we treat the final edit of the movie like the script. I'm one of the hosts, Bob Rose. You can find me at Thundergrunt Bob on Twitter and Instagram. And now Jimmy's going to introduce himself.
My name is Jimmy George. I am a screenwriter and script consultant. My Twitter handle is at Jimmy R. George.
And I am, Okay. Hey, you don't have to introduce. Why don't you give my introduction?
I just figured it was taken for granted that you'd be your next.
Yes. I'm Jamie Nash, and I'm the screenwriter of lots of movies you haven't seen, and also a book you haven't read. So save the cat race.
Two books
you haven't read. Well, you read one of them. You didn't read the other. So go buy both. And the Save the Cat worksheet. This title, it always trips me up. It's the Save the Cat Beat Sheet Workbook.
The title of your own book.
Yeah, well, I didn't necessarily title it.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
I think mine was just Save the Cat Workbook. And then they threw Beat Sheet in there. So I'm still trying to take it out. Though I like that Beat Sheet's in there. It makes a lot of sense. But nonetheless, it actually is more than a Beat Sheet Workbook. It has character stuff and journaling and brainstorming idea exercises. And this is sponsored by the Save the Cat Beat Sheet Workbook.
And also, I want to give some pushback to you, Jamie. I think a lot of people have seen Exist and Lovely Molly. I think they have a good fan base. You said nobody's seen anything.
That's just me begging for people to say, oh, I've seen that. That's my favorite movie. That's like,
I'm just uplifting my friend, okay?
That's passive-aggressive negging is what that is. Yeah.
Okay, so we're here to talk about The Princess Bride. It's obviously a classic episode, so let's go around and just talk a little bit about how this movie, our thoughts on the movie, outside of the script discussion, and I guess, I mean, this is from the 80s, so what it meant to our lives, you know? Just, you know, keep it short. Jamie, you go first.
Sure. Honestly, this is a movie, and I never really understand where or when I saw it. I don't even know when I saw it. I did not see it in the theater, which is crazy because I've seen every other movie in 1987 in the theater. So if you look, you know, this is one of my favorites to go back to. Like, these are the movies that came out in 87. I saw every one of these. Beverly Hills Cop 2, Platoon, Fatal Attraction, The Untouchables, Three Men and a Baby, Secret of My Success, Stakeout, Lethal Weapon, Witches of Eastwick, Predator, Dragnet, La Bamba. I saw all of these in the theater.
We were eating good back then, huh?
The Lost Boys.
The Lost Boys. RoboCop was then.
Right.
Dirty Dancing I probably skipped because that wasn't my tempo at the time, but I've seen since. The Living Daylights. Full Metal Jacket. I saw the drive-in. A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Mannequin, Roxanne. All these movies I saw in the theater. I did not see Princess Bride in the theater. And I'm not exactly, I don't even think I saw Princess Bride in its first iteration when it came out on VHS. I don't really know why. I don't have a deep.
You think it was the title? Like, you thought it was not for you?
Maybe I was more into, because this is, you know, probably just entering high school, movie nerd. I was into things like RoboCop was my favorite movie, you know. Maybe Princess Bride just wasn't the thing I was going to see. I don't know. It only made $30 million in 1987 domestic, and it falls 35th on the list of movies that year. So it wasn't a huge success. It was kind of under the radar. It came out in September, you know, so kind of weird month. That especially back then, that was a dead time. That was when you kind of dump things like before Christmas, but after the summer. So I don't think it was hugely heralded. I think the studios kind of were like, we'll release it. And even here, I look at all the movies in the top, I don't know. And this is kind of telling. I didn't do any research. I should have done research to really understand this. But to me, this is telling. Yeah. Of the top 50 movies, of the top 40 movies, it has the lowest theaters. It has 803 theaters. When the movie that finished after it, Throw Mama from the Train, another movie I loved as a, like, that was my stuff back then, that had 1,623 theaters and finished after The Princess Bride. So it kind of tells you that the studios weren't really pushing it. You know,
yeah, and when we get to that categorization topic, I think that's gonna gonna be circling around what the hell was going on there. So yeah,
so just to give you like the movies around it, like the ones that finished 32, 30 to 35, because this is kind of fascinating to me because I don't know why of every other one of these movies was on my radar, but The Princess Bride in 1987, Adventures in Babysitting, 32. The Lost Boys, 33. Can't Buy Me Love, another movie I probably skipped, to be honest. The Princess Bride. The Princess Bride. And Throw Mama from the Trains. And Revenge of the Nerds, Harry and the Hendersons. That's kind of how it goes.
What a year. My favorite year in cinema. Wow.
Yeah. And that's 30 to 40. You know, that's where that is. So Even the next two, Police Academy 4 is, I'm sure I saw in the
theater.
Citizens
on Patrol.
Yeah. And Eddie Murphy Raw was a huge event in my life back in 1987. Like that was like everybody went to see, you know, all the cool people went to see Eddie Murphy Raw. So
that's it. Don't remember when you just don't remember when you started watching this movie.
Oh yeah. I forgot the question, but
yeah,
yes.
It was just, so
I love when Jamie just goes,
yeah. Because this one really is a kind of a mystery to me. Like every other one I could say, I remember when I saw that movie, this one, I think I saw it much later, like maybe like 1998 later or something, or 90, you know, one day at the Blockbuster, I was like, I never saw that Princess Bride thing, and I picked it up and I watched it. I even think I may have read the book before I saw the movie. But I'm not 100% sure about that. I have the book here somewhere in my house, and I remember reading it and kind of being fascinated by it. But yeah, it was much later, and when I saw it, I definitely liked it a lot. But again, it's not like all those other movies that probably are in the 80s that are like pivotal to my love of movies and writing and
the bricks which make up the wall that is Jamie Nash.
Yeah. It's more like, oh, I can't believe I missed this one. How did I miss it? And
right.
It's got all these things I love in it. So that's where I fall with The Princess Bride.
Cool. Jimmy.
Mine's going to be short and sweet. I just saw this movie for the first time a couple years ago. It was a huge blind spot for me since, you know, screenwriting is a huge part of my life. And I finally saw it and I loved it. And I had not seen it ever since until this episode. So I just watched it two times in a row last night. And so I've seen this movie three times, two times yesterday. And
that's great, though.
Yeah, no, I know. So it was like it's fun to discover why other people loved it, and to like, because you know, when we're gonna talk about like the tone scale and stuff like that in a couple minutes, and I feel like asking these questions has made me realize before I didn't have an appreciation how it sort of created its own lane in parody lane that other movies have emulated since, but maybe didn't exist before this. Because yeah, I'll hold off until we get to that topic. Yeah. But I never really, even when I watched it, I hadn't really thought about like, oh, I wonder if there was any movie like this before this, because it's not like the Mel Brooks comedies. That's pretty much it for me. That's yeah. Cool. So it I doesn't like hold like a place on the, yeah.
I like that. It's not all like you have, it's not your childhood.
No,
like
not that. In the, not
we
in the
don't normally
slightest.
Do that. I feel like whenever we do a throwback episode, every one of us is like, yeah, we watched this as a kid. And blah, blah, blah.
No, I think you I know? Saw like clips, like when I'd be sitting at the dentist and you know, they have that stack of kid friendly VHS tapes. I think I saw like, I was like Fred Savage.
Yeah.
You know, like, like before I got my teeth drilled.
And then you watched Little Monsters first, and then you watched this.
Don't go insulting Little Monsters. I love Little Monsters.
Love
Amy.
Little Monsters. it's so funny to me how like, you know, they put these nice movies on and you can hear like teeth being drilled in the background.
Right. So this reminds Jimmy of going to the dentist, essentially.
Pretty much. Okay, go ahead, Bob. Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
I was gonna say, being the youngin of the group, youngin, I'm 40. So I obviously didn't see this in the theater, but my memory is basically cable in the 90s. It's one of those movies I watched when I was way too young, and kind of just formed my love of it over that decade, and eventually like came to love it. But I would say I had two errors of loving this movie. One was that, just like the formative years of cable, and I don't think I even had the VHS. I think I'm young enough where it's just cable on that. So, but like in the aughts, like when the Ren Faires kind of like reignited the popularity of the Ren Faire, I was dating somebody who was absolutely obsessed with the Ren Faire and would go every weekend.
Mm-hmm.
What I didn't realize was that that's when I realized that The Princess Bride was like this absolutely beloved movie that people like worshipped. Like I learned that everyone that's into the Ren Faire or works at the Ren Faire could quote this movie from beginning to end without a problem. Like, it's that beloved. Like,
that's awesome.
Like that sense of humor that the Ren Faire has, obviously the style and everything. Like, I was like, this is the movie of this large gathering of people.
Right.
And you know, so I was saturated with it, you know.
That's I think when I came to it, because I was kind of, I dabbled in that Ren Faire. I wasn't like a Ren Faire regular, but I was a juggler and a street performer. And
you could have worked there, man.
And a lot of people I knew did work there. So I kind of was around that. And I think that's when I came to this movie as well, was kind of through that world or those people.
There was an act even at the Ren Faire in the aughts that like just did scenes from Princess Bride. Like it was just so beloved. You know what I mean? Like you couldn't, like that's where it kind of reignited my like, oh, okay, so everyone else loves this movie too. And then I feel like ongoing forward in the internet age, then you just saw it blossom.
Oh, everywhere,
it's such a
beloved
movie. So like I loved it, but then I started to realize other people loved it, and that sort of made me warm up even more to it. Like, you know what I mean? When you realize something you love is beloved by a lot of people. So,
yeah.
You know, it became one of my tops just because I think over the years it's always come up. It constantly comes up.
You know? My wife has seen this movie a gazillion times, and she's my age. You know, seen it. I think I know the big difference. My dad was super cheap, and he wouldn't let us get HBO or Showtime or anything like that. So I had basic cable, I didn't have those other things. So I never. And by the way, my dad loved VHS. Like we would go to Errol's Video every week, every day.
VHS cases.
Yeah, but so. That was a different thing because I was
Jamie. Maybe this explains why I haven't seen it, because I don't know. I have gotten to tell this story how my dad was uber, like even beyond that, he refused to. He was like a format snob then, and he refused to buy VHS. He had a Beta machine, and when we would go to Errol's Video, nothing was on Beta except for WWF. And Schwarzenegger movies. So like I grew up, like we would watch all of the WrestleManias over and over because that was the only thing at the video store that was on Beta. So maybe there wasn't ever Beta versions of Princess Bride available for us to watch.
Yeah.
Now he loves HD DVD.
it's kind of like my dad loved VHS, and he would take me like almost every day could to rent a movie. He kind of controlled a little bit. Like if I would pull Princess Bride out, he might be like, eh, how about Road Warrior? And I'd be like, okay, well, to get Road Warrior, you know, or something.
Real dad choice right there.
Yeah, exactly. So where my wife had cable, she had all the cable, and she said she watches so many times. Like when I turned it on, she's like, oh, why are you watching that? I have that movie memorized. So much so that I think every time I leave the house, she says, have fun storming the castle. I mean,
that's great. Right.
So anyway, I think it's a cable. I think it's a big cable.
I was lucky enough to have HBO as a kid. That was our
that's
cable.
Awesome.
So yeah, I was privileged in that way. I'll say that. But now that we've all proved we're old. Very old. We mentioned Betamax tapes and all this stuff. You know, we're old.
Errol's
Video.
Before it was internet.
Yeah. I'm sure we have some 20-year-old listeners like, what the fuck
is Errol's
Video?
One of my first email addresses was an Errol's email address just because I think mine,
I had the Errol's for a long time, like to the aughts. I had Errol's.
I remember Errol's, but since I'm slightly younger, my primary video store was actually Hollywood Video.
Hollywood, yeah.
Yeah,
you
same.
Remember Hollywood Video.
On the second part, of, yeah.
I still think of Hollywood and Blockbuster as the new video stores. Because Errol's was the original.
They were the big deal.
It was like Errol's and Mom and Pop, and then Blockbuster and Hollywood came, and they were the new kids in town, you know.
Oh boy. All right. Jamie, who wrote this shit?
Yeah, William Goldman.
Kind of mentioned him. So,
Well, William Goldman wrote this. And again, there's part of me that's like, maybe I didn't watch Princess Bride until I was aware of William Goldman. Because in the 90s, I started looking into screenwriting. And for the most part, what that meant was I started to get books on screenwriting, like Sid Field's book. And of course, William Goldman has this great book that everybody would get called, what was it called?
Adventures in Screen Trade.
And then he wrote a sequel like many years later as well. And that is a great book. Like that's a book I've read multiple times and I could probably pull it out. Maybe I should pull it out today and start reading it again, because I'm sure I forgot like some of it. And it's the stuff I love. Like if you listen to this podcast or you know me, I'm a big behind the scenes fan, especially development, writing, directing. I love that stuff. And that was like might have been one of the first books I really read that did all that. So he was almost like this kind of guru. Like before we had podcasts, like now we have John August and Craig Mazin to do the stuff. I think William Goldman was that before them, but he didn't have podcasts, so he had to do it in books and stuff like that. And he was a hugely successful screenwriter as well, which, you know, I'll just go through a couple of his things. But he got started before this. I think he met Paul Newman on Masquerade or something. Was it that one? But he did Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was really the one that launched him. And then he did things like The Stepford Wives, The Great Waldo Pepper, Marathon Man, All the President's Men, A Bridge Too Far. He did Magic. He did, you know, all these different things. And then he did the Princess Bride, of course, Misery. And then his career even kept going. He did things like Memoirs of Invisible Man, Bob's favorite movie.
I love that movie.
I knew you would.
I love that movie.
Just had a feeling you'd love that movie.
That's a cable classic, sir.
Another one that Bob loves, You're the Comet.
Yeah, that's good.
Chaplin, Maverick. You know, so he had a long career. Let's see where it ended up. He ended up Dreamcatcher. Sorry.
Yeah, that's a cautionary screenwriting tale right there.
You know, I think it's a fun watch. It's not a good movie, but it's a fun watch.
The cool thing with him, like in his later book, he might even talk, I can't remember, he might even talk about Dreamcatcher. But he talks about all his movies, the good and the bad, the development hell. There are some great movies of his. Like I remember I wrote a Blackbeard script that ended up being a comic book years ago. And I remember reading he wrote a Blackbeard script many years ago as well. That was everybody loved, but never got made. And he has stories about that as well. So a long career. And the other thing I thought might be interesting was to talk a little bit about his screenwriting style, because in some ways he was the original Shane Black. And
when you say that, you mean like the actual writing of the screenplay, like how Shane Black would add in amazing lines for people reading them?
Right, like Shane Black would
editorials and stuff. Yeah.
Shane Black kind of jumped on the scene, and everybody started to adopt his style. He'd say things like, "Hold on to your popcorn, boys and girls, because we're about to have the greatest fight you've ever seen," or something like that in the middle of the script.
Yeah, and he's the famous one is it's a huge mansion, the type of one that I'm gonna buy when I sell the script.
Right.
Right.
And like I wanted to give you an example. So this is a cut from like the early part of the screenplay. And this is in the duel scene, the famous duel scene. And he says the two of them, he does this weird thing that I hate, by the way. I'm not sure where Jimmy stands on it. I hate when people use characters as slug lines, but Goldman, it's something he does regularly. So he'll say the two of them in in bold, like a slug line, like a mini slug. You know, so a lot of times you'll see in scripts, like people might say on Jamie
and close then, and on Jamie. Line. Yeah.
And
yeah.
And there's all this. I don't know why I've always hated that.
Pardon me. Are you asking where I stand?
Yeah,
on
where,
it?
Do you, where, do you, where do you stand? Where do you stand on the infamous?
I think it's a case by case basis. I'm not a fan of it, but I have seen it on the page where I get why they're doing it, and it's fine. Yeah, I would say it's fine. I don't like it, but it's fine.
You can tolerate it.
I'll tell you the reason I don't like it, though, is because I think it's because I've been on the other side of, you know, production and directing. So when you go, if you stick to locations and you do this, mm-hmm. you can flip a bit and number all the scenes. But when I see the two of them and I'm doing a breakdown, I'm like, what the hell is that?
It's a producer's nightmare. For
it's
sure.
a producer's it's nightmare
from a production draft. But like, you know, most people listening to this are writing spec scripts, so it's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not an issue.
It's
yeah.
just something I've never. I always stay like whenever I'm co-writing with somebody and they start doing it, I sneakily edit it out.
I'll remember not to do that if we ever write anything together.
I don't know why. I don't know why. It just always bugs me. It turns me off in scripts.
It'll be page one and it'll be like the two
right,
of them.
Right. But William Goldman, like,
you fucking asshole.
William Goldman does it regularly. It's his thing. He also uses a lot of cut twos and at the same time. He uses cut twos all over his script. So he's kind of from the 70s, you know, his mm-hmm. writing style. And
plus he's a novelist, right?
So. And he's a novelist. Yeah. So he did a lot of this stuff. But anyway, so I'm not a big fan of like, go read William Goldman's scripts to learn how to format necessarily. But I will say, go read William Goldman's scripts to learn style and how to
voice.
Have a cool, fun style. Yeah.
Voice, yes.
So the two of them. And what we are starting now is one of the two greatest sword fights in modern movies. The other one happens later on. And right from the beginning, it looks different. Because they aren't close to each other. None of the sword crossing unguarded garbage. No, what we have here is two men, two athletes, and they look to be too far away to damage each other. But each time one makes even the tiniest feint, the other counters, and there's silence. And as they start to circle, and then so that's the only, I was just going to read that little clip.
Good. You, yeah. Yeah. Very different than right now, 2023, typical script rhythm. Yeah.
Right. So he's kind of commenting on it. He's kind of having fun. He's kind of doing his thing.
It's the tone of the movie a bit.
It's the tone of the movie. Yeah. You know,
I encourage screenwriters to do, make the voice of the narrative match the tone of the movie.
Make mm-hmm. make yeah. your script yeah. feel like the movie. That's mm-hmm. what I, you know, if it feels like the movie when you're reading it, that's a really good, really good thing. And the only other thing to say about William Goldman and this movie is it was based on a book. He wrote the book, I think, in 1973. I mentioned it earlier. The book is it's a very interesting book.
I was gonna say real quick, I have not ever read the book.
Me neither.
It's
Jamie,
fun.
Have you? Okay. So Jamie, you're the only source for the book here.
Yeah, and it's fun because it's this weird kind of book that it's deconstructionist and postmodernistic in its own way, but a different way than the movie. So the book is about William Goldman readapting an abridged version of this old book that, you know, doesn't really exist, but it kind of has conversations or why he does things or how he wants to write a scene in that wasn't in the original, and he writes it anyway, and all this kind of stuff. So it kind of has this running commentary on, it's almost like adaptation in some ways, you know. It's this weird running.
So it's way more self-aware than.
It's 100% self-aware.
And, so the movie, instead of doing that, it's the Fred Savage thing. This, like, they're saying the framing device is William Goldman himself in the book.
Yes.
Okay. I didn't actually know that.
Yes.
That's wow.
Yeah, and all these years I didn't know that.
And it's kind of like his trouble. Like supposedly he's adapting this old book that had thousands and thousands of pages. And he's almost giving a running commentary on what works and what doesn't. So it's kind of an insight into the adaptation process in a weird
sort of way
by William Goldman.
I did not know that.
And the title is called The Princess Bride, S. Morgan Stern's classic tale of true love and high adventure. And S. Morgan Stern is supposedly the writer of the original, you know,
that he's trying to adapt into a movie.
He is writing the abridged version, not adapt to a movie, but writing the abridged version for modern audiences.
Gotcha.
And the book is it's funny, right? Like that.
The book is 100% that voice.
Okay.
It's just funny because he's kind of playing himself as a character in some ways, you know. And it kind of has interludes, and it'll stop, you know, in the middle of it and say, you know, comment on it and things like that. But it's actually quite a fun read, and I remember when I read it, it was very eye opening to me. In the novel sense, like it was kind of the type of novel I kind of was a little jealous of and wanted to write myself.
And so since he's the screenwriter of the movie, he adapted a book where he's adapting another book. He's adapting that into a screenplay and adding a new framing device that would also incorporate his voice into it. Right? Am I getting that all right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. That's like
yes.
kind of unprecedented, isn't
very
it?
Like, complicated
it's
approach.
Very complicated.
And,
yeah.
And I think the fact that he is a screenwriter and he was probably the pro screenwriter, it kind of says something to the fact that he took this, he kept the spirit of it,
mm-hmm.
but he knew it wouldn't work cinematically as well as would he.
Right.
Did, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, no, and it gives it like I feel like he kind of gives that voice to the grandpa a little bit and everything. I always got the sense that when watching the movie that the grandpa was adding stuff, you know, to make it more fun for the kid, but they don't ever tell you that, you know? So like you're getting his voice in the book and you're getting grandpa's voice in the movie.
Yeah. If I remember the book, I should have picked that up. I think it even starts with him talking about how as a kid, he didn't like to read and stuff. So it kind of starts with similar vibe as to what we have, you know, he kind of explains
cynicism towards it and everything.
Yeah. Like he says how I can't remember if he'd never read the book, but he knows the story or, you know, something like that. So there's a lot of similarity, even though it's very different with what he did.
Well, I think that brings us to a good question is, what category does this movie live in? Right, like,
tone, yeah, Jamie, you brought this up, and now I'm so glad you did because I hadn't really thought of it.
Yeah,
that's what I was just saying. Yeah,
yeah, and honestly, this movie it's kind of unique, but in modern terms, I think we've seen things since then that aren't too far away from it. Right.
I think it's inspired a lot of things.
That's yes. Which I hadn't realized until you brought this up. Yeah.
But then as I was thinking about that, I was like, well, there are things that I think are kind of like it in the past as well. So I started to have an internal debate and I figured we could share it together and see what you guys think.
What are your past examples,
yeah,
Jamie,
yeah, give
before
us some
it?
Of those.
Yeah. So the past. So one thing I want to say about this, though, before I start. Is this one operates on a weird, we're not going to talk about structure or anything,
yeah,
but it operates on a weird, you know, my dramatic question, will the hero succeed or will the horrible thing happen? That is in there in a very kind of, there's a certain sense of it, but it all feels so safe and nobody seems to care too much about that it doesn't play the tension levels mm-hmm. like a regular movie as
and
much.
Well, we know that the characters are listening. It's a book.
It's a book.
It's a fantasy book from the old days, so we figure it's going to have the storybook ending, right?
It's
a storybook. It's going to have a storybook ending.
Yeah. So it's almost more like, and I think there are many other, like I've been watching Poker Face on Peacock, which I really love.
Spoilers.
I haven't seen it.
It's an episodic show, so there's really no spoilers to have. Okay. But, and much like Columbo, who happens to be in this movie.
Yeah.
it becomes less about whodunit or will they succeed, because they're going to succeed every episode. Columbo's going to succeed, right? Maybe right. That's a spoiler. I don't know. Maybe you thought.
Damn it, Jamie. Can't watch Columbo.
Yeah. But so then it becomes about almost like, how will they succeed? And that's mm-hmm. the tension level, or that's the itch we need to scratch. How is he going to figure this out? What fun way is the writer going to give me to figure this out? How are they going to show me something different? And that's different than what I normally preach to people. But it is a thing. And when I watch Poker Face, I'm like, I'm not tense during this at all, because I know she's going to solve it. And in fact, they kind of lay their cards on the table, no pun intended, for that show very early on. And it just becomes how. It's the how question. It's a how. Yeah. Done it.
You know? We didn't put, you know, again, we're not going to talk about structure. We're also not going to talk about villain's plan. But I think there is something instructive that we know Humperdinck's plan very early on. Mm-hmm. And no one else in the movie does, like, besides Tyrone. And I think we have superior position right. over all the other characters. So there is this thing where, even though, you know, the heroes may not have a goal that's related to stopping the villain's plan, there's still, you know, we know that he's planning on having her killed. And that does create this sense of, like, overarching. But I agree, Jamie, it right. doesn't feel tense. Like, the momentum, we cut it off of the back end of the talking points. But the momentum for me is, what funny thing is going to happen next? What funny character is going to show up that subverts it all? In a new way, because it's constantly delivering something subversive and funny and memorable. The momentum for me is like, okay, here comes another set piece. What are they going to do with it that's fun, you know, that I've never seen before?
It's also plays on just the audience's expectation of storytelling. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no, like, even as a kid when I watched it, there's no way that a movie would keep saying, you know, Inigo would keep talking about getting revenge for his father, and that the movie would not let him get revenge for his father.
Right.
You know
right.
what I you mean? Like, coming. I knew it yeah. was coming, and I just needed, like Jamie said, it was, how will he get revenge for
yep.
his father?
Yep.
I knew it was going to happen. So the tension of will it or not happen was never kind of in the cards, you know?
Yeah. And the only reason I bring that part up, that's not necessarily a question, but is because I've been watching Poker Face and this, and I've been asking myself, you know, how are these, what, why do we keep watching? And I think there is something about this process driven, how is it going to unfold, that mm-hmm. sometimes does work in the most well executed things. I wouldn't necessarily choose that as my first choice for a storytelling. yeah. I would, but if it's super well executed, like Poker Face and this, then it can work, and it does work. And also the fact that this is a comedy, like Airplane is one of my favorite movies as a kid and as an adult. And I'm not necessarily worried, are they going to die in the plane crash?
Right, I mean, right. You know, That's not the point of Airplane.
Yeah. It's just not. I'm not like, oh, my God, will they die? Oh, no, I'm so stressed. It's
but that's
not.
A great example, Airplane, because tonally, they're both doing the same things, but the level of self-awareness is so different from the characters. Like, everybody in Airplane knows they're in Airplane.
Yeah.
And they're both lampooning their respective genre. Mm-hmm. Right.
The old thing, though, that I would compare it to, and I honestly think you could almost say that this could be in this person's, is Mel Brooks. Because when I think of
who made a movie with Cary Elwes.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah, Men in Tights. Yeah.
Which honestly was probably more Airplane than Princess Bride in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I think Young Frankenstein is an example of a movie that operates very similar to this. I don't think it's just outright spoof and we're going to make jokes and it's going to be like Airplane, he's turned into jelly or something like that.
Totally agree.
It has a real world in its own weird sense, but it's making fun of things. But in fact, I'd almost say Young Frankenstein takes itself more seriously than this movie in some ways, but maybe because it doesn't have the framing device.
It's doing it to horror movies.
Old
we should do that on a classic sometime. Hell yeah.
Probably yes. I mean, that was already gonna, yeah, definitely.
And this movie even feels a little like a Mel Brooks movie at times, you know, I mean, with some of the casting and you know, Reiner is kind of, he's a similar, I think he's got a similar sense of humor in some ways.
Meathead.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But you know what, Jamie, like when you asked this, when you put this question on the talking points, I was like, you know what, to me, and I'm going to bring up examples that are come after this, not before this, to me, it's way more in line with like Galaxy Quest and Shrek and Last Action Hero and Clue.
They were all the ones I was going to bring up too.
Okay. I didn't mean to steal your thunder.
No.
Murder by Death. They're all like genre, like winking genre.
They're love letters to their genre, but they're satires that also tell their own version of that.
I think even to an extent, I mean, if we did like a tone chart of it.
Yeah.
It's funny because Terry Rossio and Ted Elliott, I think they wrote a bunch of movies that are sort of similar, like you said Aladdin, you said Shrek. I think even Pirates
of the Caribbean,
it's kind of winking at you, even though it takes it a little more seriously.
You could also stretch a little bit and maybe point to the Cornetto trilogy a little bit.
Yes, yes. Hot Fuzz
and Shaun of the Dead. Yeah.
Shaun of the Dead is absolutely ever so slightly parodying, leaning on the parody side of zombie movies while also being its own zombie movie.
And Galaxy Quest was the first one that came to mind for me as well.
Yeah. Which we've done on this show. So you can scroll back in our timeline, you can find it.
Yeah. But I was like, it's not, it doesn't lean, the characters don't know they're in The Princess Bride. Is the thing, like, you know what I mean? And that's, I think the self-awareness is that I was watching, there's a great, I don't think it's on the Blu-ray, but maybe I'm wrong, there's a great PBS documentary called As You Wish, and I was watching that last night, and Mandy, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Patinkin, said that Rob Reiner's sort of compass for the tone of the performances that he gave the actors was, I want you all, you have all your cards in your hand, and that this is a movie and you're acting in this movie and you know you're acting in a movie. And I want you to pretend that you're leaning the cards toward the screen, but just enough that they can't see what cards you're holding. Like, and I think that's like a great.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. That like totally captures what the movie is. And
I think that's a little bit why it's different than a little bit tonally different than Galaxy Quest, because they're showing a little bit. They know they're holding cards. Where Galaxy Quest, they don't have the cards. They're
at all.
No, it's
they don't have the cards.
It's totally sincerely acted.
Good call. Good call. Yeah.
And I think that's a Mel Brooks kind of thing.
There's a wink to this movie.
There is.
Without it being like Airplane.
Yes,
like that's like the, you know how we always talk about the Batman tonal scale. You call
we didn't
the
talk about
total scale. Of
there's
stuff,
a parody you know? Scale, right? Yeah, it's like where on the spoof scale,
Airplane is
on
like
the
10.
Satire scale does it run? You know,
right.
Yeah, and like that's really difficult to pull off. I mean, talk about a tightrope of going too far or not enough. You know,
that's why I brought up Edgar Wright, because I remember when those movies were coming out, everyone was kind of like, "What are these?" Like, there was that discussion of what are these? Are these homages? Mm-hmm. Are they parody movies? What do they count as? You know, and I think you could make that case here. But this also has that. I feel like the framing device is such an important part of this discussion, right? Like, most of those movies we mentioned don't have that.
I was excited to ask Jamie, because we've only talked about this one time, and that was in the When Harry Met Sally, another Rob Reiner movie. Jamie, do you use framing devices often? What is your experience with it, first of all?
I do use them, especially in kids' movies. I don't know why. Maybe it's they probably are a little Princess Bride, to be honest. It's almost become shorthand to do it that way, right? It's like somebody telling a story. Usually when I do them, it's very similar to Princess Bride in that they're almost making, in some ways, it's a big insecurity line for the whole movie, isn't it? That's what
meta,
it is, right?
Yeah.
But it's delicately delivered.
It's basically like, wait a minute, that's stupid. You know,
well, the bad version of it is that. Yes.
Yeah. The good version is Fred Savage being a kid going, I don't want to.
Right.
I don't want to see kissing. You're right.
Yeah.
Him having an arc, I think, is what makes the movie great.
Yes. When Jamie was talking about the tension, it was making me think about Will Fred Savage come around and realize, And what were you going to say, Jamie?
I think the key to them is, and it I should have almost listed like what movies have framing devices, because there's probably several different types of things that you could look at. But I think the key is that there needs to be like some kind of movement or some story to be told, like, and as opposed to just popping back with nothing. It's kind of like when you watch an anthology movie, and the good anthologies kind of tell a story with the framing device. They kind of get worse and worse. And people are like, that framing device was really good. It had an ending. It kind of, and then there's another version where it just kind of almost works as like the horror host in some ways, where it's like, okay, and the next one is this, and the next one is this. And I always think, especially for a story like this, you have to have a story told within the frame, even if it's a small story. This isn't a huge story. It's just a kid and his granddad kind of debating over the night's entertainment in some ways. And that's all the story is. And there's an arc there. He goes from somebody that hates kissing scenes to somebody that wants to hear about the kissing scenes. That's a character arc. That's an opening.
No, he's a different person that would do a different thing at the end than he would at the beginning.
Exactly. His before and after snapshot. There, we see it. Yeah.
Right.
And the only other thing I'd say is, if you're using a framing device, be sure, and the same thing goes for voiceover. If you're using, because voiceover is sort of
they usually go hand in hand.
They usually go hand in hand. My big thing is, go for it with your voice. Let it rip. Because the thing I hate most is when the voiceover is just bland and boring. Because I actually think if you let it rip, you can really give a big dose of voice with your framing device.
I'm thinking, since we already talked Shane Black, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang with voiceover, right? As far as let it rip for voiceover.
The opposite of that is the Blade Runner voiceover.
Right.
I was tired. I couldn't figure out the mystery.
Well, that's because he didn't even want to do it.
Yeah.
That was my terrible Harrison Ford impression.
It was pretty bad, man.
sadly, too. Yeah, you might get the job as being the next Indiana Jones.
Yeah, you can Dial of Destiny.
Most of the ones I read, and this is why I'm so much like, let it rip, is most of the ones I read, maybe they start out with a good line and then they settle into exactly what you just did. It's just
that's
like,
right, yeah,
this is, you know, then this, I was sad, you know, and it's like, oh man,
I was sad. No, but the reason,
I mean, you're breaking the fourth wall, Jamie, essentially, right? So why not have fun? You're breaking through, right?
I'm a big fan of, like, I always say Margot Robbie in a bathtub is kind of a good, what I mean by letting it rip.
Man,
you know?
The Big Short is
directed by a comedy director.
And that's not even a framing device per se. That's just
exposition.
A voice.
Yeah.
It's just a voice. But I think if you're going to have a voice, that's the kind of swing, or if you're going to have a framing device, you want to take a big swing with it and make it interesting. That's my gut. But I mean, it depends on the project, I guess.
So, Jamie, I did make a list because I read break out your bingo cards, because I read amateur scripts 5 days a week. I just put down one right before we started recording this. So, like, I read a lot of bad framing devices. And I think what's instructive about this movie is, so I have sort of a list, and this isn't just a list that that is specific to framing devices. It's sort of like a litmus test for any gimmick that works, because I consider a framing device a structural gimmick, because like it does all the things that a good gimmick does when it's used right. My litmus test is it cohesive? Does it flow organically between the framing device and the rest of the story? This absolutely does, as opposed to being wholly unrelated. So the bad version is a framing device that you cut back to the framing device and it literally has nothing to do with the story whatsoever. I read that a lot. The second one, it enhances the story. It adds texture to it, as opposed to adding nothing to it. So the same thing, I'll read framing devices that they don't actually do anything with it that adds to you know, creates this sense of texture between the two, the framing device and then the A story. It's consistent. So this is the big one that I see all the time, which is instead of coming back to the framing device every 20 minutes, every, you know, maybe every like 15 to 20% of the story, we get either the framing device starts at the beginning and then we never come back to the framing device until the end of the movie. So we literally get a bookend of frames and that's it. Or we get this weird thing, which I surprisingly see a lot, which is we get this late framing device where it like starts in the middle. All of a sudden we have like a wraparound that had no beginning. And then we get like one scene in the end. So we get a middle and an end, but no beginning. So this one, you know, I didn't track it, but I would bet you that we go back to the framing device at least every 20 minutes. It's very consistent. You never forget about what's happening with the kid and the grandpa as it relates to the events we're seeing unfold in the Princess Bride world. So consistency is important. It tells, like Jamie said, it tells its own complete story. Because like that's another big one I see all the time where there is no story in the framing device. All it's doing is trying to find a way to go back and forth between the framing story and the actual story, but it doesn't have characters with their own arcs. It doesn't have your before and after snapshot. It doesn't have
why is it there
middle and any right. So why it just there? it doesn't tell its own story. And then the big one is it's thematic, which this one absolutely is about the power of love. And, you know, it earns its place, you know, and then some just by being thematic. And, you know, if your framing device isn't thematic, then how can you try to make it so that it is? And again, so that's the list for me. Is it cohesive? Does it enhance the rest of the story? Is it consistent? Like, is it used consistently? Does it tell its own story? And is it thematic? So if you're using a framing device, think about those things. And the Princess Bride framing device does all of those things very simply, right? Like,
it's so
only
simple,
like,
but
it's so simple.
The whole movie almost feels like it's built just so that you know, Peter Falk can say, as you wish.
Yeah,
to his grandson.
Absolutely.
Like, it seems like that was
okay.
The reason we were here. No, I'm not. That's great. It's great. That's just a wonderful ending, isn't it? And it's so simple. it's so simple.
Sometimes simple is better.
Yeah. Well, we kind of talked about categorizing this. And we already said are we calling it a romantic comedy? I can tell you guys this. We always seem to talk about this, but in a video store, this was in my video store that I managed. This was put in the fantasy section.
It's a fantasy first. For
it was
sure.
It was put in the fantasy section, but once again, I feel like much like with the menu, I would put it in the comedy section personally. But I know it would piss off customers maybe a little bit. You know what I mean?
So the reason I put this on the talking points for a couple reasons, and you guys can like bounce off of it when I start going
sure.
through it. But one, when I looked at it, I was like, oh shit, I've never really thought about this as a romantic comedy, but all of this stuff seems to be relevant. And then two, we've only talked about this one other time in 92 episodes, and that was When Harry Met Sally, a Ryan movie, as we said. So I thought it would be fun to go through it. So this is 5 Secrets of Romantic Comedies. And this comes from, there's a book. Jamie, have you read this book by Billy Murnett, Writing the Romantic Comedy?
No, I don't think I've ever heard of it.
There's been other books that have come out that are focused on how to write a romantic comedy, but in the early 2000s there was only one, and it was this one. And I actually
and that was
went,
the boom of romantic comedy,
right? Exactly. Yeah. And I actually went to this guy's romantic comedy writing seminar in LA years ago. He's very nice. He was very good at the seminar. So he wasn't, not that Robert McKee, I'm sure he's a good person, but you know, he really is like kind of a dick, just like they portray him in adaptation.
Can you imagine the guy who gave the romantic comedy spiel was a
dick?
If your characters don't fall in love by the
love stinks. Yeah. These movies
screaming
are bullshit.
About Katherine Heigl movies and stuff.
No. So I'm going to give his 5 tips And then as we're going down the list, we can like, it's pretty much, I think the Princess Bride does all these things. So, the central plot must always be connected to the romantic relationship. So the central story question should always be, will these two people become a couple?
Right down the center. Right.
Right down the center.
I mean, though, and also like the villain's plan is about marrying her. So it's about like love.
It's the antithesis of that. Yes. Yeah, Good call. Show chemistry on the page. We have to see these two characters interact, and we should spend every scene with the couple saying to ourselves, they should be together.
As you wish. I mean,
done. That definitely tracks.
Yeah.
Tell the love story using a dual protagonist model. I definitely think, right? Like, we spend an equal amount of time with her when they're separated. We get buttercup.
The only thing I'd say is she is really a undeveloped character. Almost to the point that she's a MacGuffin, and to an extent. She's like the trophy they're fighting over. But times where we spend with her and we spend with him.
Yeah, so to the point that we even get a dream sequence from her. So
that's true. I also think that her, I think that she's rounded out a bit when, like, with the ending getting darker and her wanting to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
I think that says a lot gives about her
some
character,
yeah, some everything. Depth.
So yeah, it gets there. Yeah.
But I agree, Jamie.
I can see what you're saying in the beginning.
Yeah, the one place this movie doesn't age well is like, you know, her lack of. Of death, for sure. The next one, tweak the love story formula. Tell it non-traditionally. So, like, some great examples are Sleepless in Seattle, the lovers meet in the end. Four Weddings and a Funeral, the lovers meet at weddings and funerals. Groundhog Day, it's a love story with the same day over and over. Defending Your Life, the lovers meet each other after they're dead.
Right. Yeah.
So I think this one does it. Definitely. It's non-traditional in how we're seeing it. They're characters in a story, right? Like that's being read to a child. So I think that's a very non-traditional.
In a weird way, they're even not real people.
Right. They're not. The lovers aren't real.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. That's good. Romantic means sexy, comedy means funny. You got to deliver on the comedic promise of the premise. That one, definitely.
Yeah.
You got to deliver on the sexual tension promise. Creates physical situations that force sexual tension and romantic set pieces and romantic dialogue. And I feel like it has all of those, right?
Down the hill, even in the swamp, all that stuff that has sexual tension. Yeah.
All of that stuff. It should be about something. It must have thematic resonance related to relationships. And when we did the When Harry Met Sally, the debate was, is it possible for a man and woman to be friends and not lovers? And I feel like this one is totally like about the power of true love, right? Which is all relationship based, right? Yeah. And I think it even goes beyond that, like to platonic.
I'm trying to think of how to even word it, but it's also like something about like how he will always find her, like love will always find a way. Something like that. Not to bring Jurassic Park into it.
No,
but love will always find a way. Like he went over oceans and stuff, and he still found her in her time of need. You know.
So yeah, I thought that it does all of these things. So right. I thought it was worth talking about for anyone who might be.
That's a good list.
Yeah, it's a good list. Yeah. It's a good little tips to brainstorm off of. So
it's amazing how it works as a romantic comedy. And also, you could put it in so many other categories. It's a little bit of everything, right?
It is a little bit of everything.
But as I said, I still think it's a comedy. And that brings us to talking about the funny filters.
Jamie, you
types of jokes, right?
Jamie, you were the one to originally bring this up, right? When we did the Wayne's World episode.
I don't remember, but I trust that you're right.
Jamie, I don't remember either, so it's not just you.
I do remember the list, though. So this was, I think, was an Onion writer. It was the 11 types of jokes, and we went through the 11 types of jokes, and we just kind of saw like if they were used in this movie. And I think our consensus is they probably are, right?
Yeah.
Right. This movie is comedy enough that it has at least a taste. Now, keep in mind, these were written by an Onion writer. So they're almost more literary the way they're described.
Are. Yeah. So, a lot of the times when I was looking for examples, which I cheated, you know, I looked for examples, whereas I'm going to quiz you guys off the top. Yeah,
we're coming into this cold, just so everyone knows. Yep.
And I have the backup.
You guys
examples.
Quizzed me for Wayne's World. Remember, Jamie put me on the spot for Wayne's World. I was expected to. I did it though. I came
you
up
did.
With one every time.
But Jamie, to your time. But Jamie, to your point, everything I found is almost all dialogue based, which it's very literary, the written word. So, I think you said in the Wayne's World that this doesn't include sarcasm or sight gags, and this movie has a lot of sarcasm and a lot of sight gags.
Yeah, like there's no like slapstick kind of stuff in this much. Yeah. But I mean, some of them could be. I'm sure if we went through and really wanted to rewrite the list, we could kind of stretch what they're saying to
be visual.
Right.
Yeah.
Visual.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So
take it with a grain of salt. There might be a few more that this misses that are more cinematic and less, because it's hard to do a sight gag when you're writing an Onion article, unless you have the picture. I guess if you have the pictures, but for the literary side,
it's a tool, not a rule, right?
Tool. Like it's a brainstorming tool,
right? Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And go ahead, Jamie.
No, we'll go. You finish yours, but I was.
I was just going to say one more thing before we start going down the list. Is the point here is, I'm sure Jamie reads them too. I read a lot of comedy scripts that are sent my way, and people are really good at one type of joke. And then what you have is you have a script with one type of joke. It's not the same joke, but it's the same style of comedy joke over and over and over. And when we did Wayne's World, Jamie broke down the first 2 minutes and there was like 20 jokes and they ran the gamut of these 11 styles of jokes. So we had 11 different types of jokes stacked on top of each other back to back. 22 of them in 2 minutes. And so it's just, it speaks to the fact that like, you want to challenge yourself if you're writing a comedy to vary the styles of jokes so that we're not just getting it. Otherwise it just feels repetitive and it starts to get tiring. You know, it starts to not be funny.
I'd love to point out something we talked about before we started recording too, which is like, this is something that some people are just innately do. Like if you watch master comedians, they just innately know these types of jokes and how to shuffle them around.
Right. Like, they're not like, oh, I need a parody right now. I need something relatable. Right, right.
Mike Myers is not doing that. You know, he's not.
They're not doing that. They're doing it intuitively. But right. I think comedy can be taught. And I think comedy.
No. Yeah. In script writing, especially. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway. Yeah.
So, Jamie, you're reading this?
Yeah. So, number one is irony. And their definition is intended meaning is opposite of literal meaning.
And the Onion article is alcoholic father disappointed in pothead son. That's the Onion example.
Well, I'd almost want to say like it's the inconceivable joke a little bit, right?
A little bit.
until it's actually told to us. Like the first couple of times he says it.
Mm-hmm. Irony was the one I had the hardest with. I found one that I think tracks, go ahead, Jamie.
I was going to say I had trouble like some of the ones I initially was putting in irony, I thought belonged in wordplay, which we get to later. So like somebody saying something like a few more steps and we'll be safe in the fire swamp. Is that wordplay or is that irony?
Right.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Couldn't quite tell. I put it under wordplay, but go to me.
The one that I thought does track with this is when Grandpa's doing the voiceover of after Fezzik is drunk. I mean, after Inigo is drunk, Grandpa does a voiceover and says, Fezzik took great care in reviving Inigo. Meanwhile, what we're seeing is him dumping him
in the thing.
Barrels violently. So that's definitely irony. And so that's the one ironic joke that I found. Okay.
So number two, and I think this is the most important one for mm-hmm. our writers out there. And I think this is the one that there's the most of these in, mm-hmm. in Princess Bride, and it's character.
Yeah.
So it's comedic character acting on personality traits. And I just as an instructional thing, I think a lot of people who think they're funny because they write like funny lines of dialogue or clever things. But I think really, and part of that is part of character, but I think these character things are really what are going to get you to the next level in comedy. If you excel in these, for a screenwriter, this is kind of what takes it to the next level. But with that, what do you think?
I mean, comes to mind instantly is the Vizzini thing. Vizzini's death scene.
Yeah.
Is how he thinks he's an absolute genius who can outthink
yeah.
Dread Pirate Roberts.
It's the same one. That's the exact same one.
That's the one I was going to use too. Yeah. So we're all, it's the perfect example of that. Yeah.
It's a hardcore example of it.
I feel like Vizzini is the easiest one to be like, there's that office writer's thing we've talked about in the past, which is what makes your character funny at a wedding, what makes your character funny at a funeral, what makes your character funny at a grocery store. I feel like Vizzini would be like in the aisle, like holding like a cereal box while other people are trying to get their sealer, like telling them all about the ingredients and how much he knows about their cereal.
I mean, that character could be like a Blackadder type character where you could just put him throughout different genres and time periods and he would always be funny.
Yeah.
Because if he just had that disposition, he's always funny, right?
Right.
Yeah. He thinks he's a genius and he's really annoying. Yeah, it works. Yeah. It's character stuff. All right.
Okay. Number three, reference. Common experiences that audiences can relate to.
I was saying we should rename this to relatable.
Right. I mean, mine simply, I think the no kissing is a bit this in some ways, like
a little bit. Yeah.
Even as a parent, like we can relate to a kid, like how kids act or something like that. So to me, I almost viewed it as that, like that's an example of
an
experience I can relate to. Yeah.
A weird one for me is Miracle Max covering the pill in chocolate.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah,
putting medicine
makes the medicine go down
easy, right? It's like just that.
No, I think that's a good one.
I thought of two. So this is great. We're all we already had two and I got two more. Get some rest. If you haven't got your health, you haven't got anything. Like and then Fezzik finding the stinky and drunken stinky Inigo, and he's like, "Ooh, you don't look so good. You don't smell so good either." That's just funny because we can all relate to that, right? You know, like So there were four examples of those of that type
there's
of
probably
joke.
There's probably so many.
Yeah.
Okay, number four. Shock. Surprising jokes typically involving sex, drugs, gross out humor, swearing. This one surprisingly isn't so prevalent in this movie as mm-hmm. much as some others. Yeah.
I found one. Bob, do you have any before I go
it? No, you go for it. Let me think.
It is when she's about to kill herself with the dagger. She's got the dagger to her chest. Buttercup. Off screen, Wesley interrupts her and says, "There's a shortage of perfect breasts in the world. Would be a pity to damage yours." That's definitely shocking and fits the sexual nature of the joke construction. So
I don't know, this might fit in another category, but I would say his description of To the Pain.
I put that in a different one, but yeah.
Him describing it is pretty visceral.
Shocking, yeah.
Yeah, it's shocking.
To the Pain.
And it's a little bit gross out too, just the description of it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking there's probably something in the torture scene or something, but I didn't have anything specific for it. But it could be there.
The Mel Smith as the albino torture guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's gross to look at. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that was in the script, but he is a grotesque being on screen. So,
but it's funny somehow.
Well, he's really close to Cary Elwes's face while he's like tied down. So I don't know. That's kind of a gross out thing.
That is gross out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so five, parody, mimic a familiar character, trope, or cliche in an unfamiliar way.
I mean, the whole movie is an exploration of this, but for me, the one that comes to mind the most is the wedding officiant. I mean, that's the, you know, like, what if your wedding officiant couldn't pronounce love or marriage? Like, that's pretty fucking funny.
Geez, yeah, it feels like that
everything.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah, everything.
I would say
you give your Merlin example with Miracle Max.
Oh yeah, right. Because Merlin's usually like a mystical figure who is very, you know, stately spoken, and you know, but then we just have Billy Crystal being like Billy Crystal from like from like, you know, New York or something, and he's just,
yeah,
he's very modern in his delivery, yes, in an unexpected way. You
right.
You could also say that about the Torturer. They both have mm-hmm. that joke about them, like they're yeah. just like they're like from 1987.
You know? Yeah, like, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of the Mel Brooks kind of thing, where all these people have American accents. They're not trying to really
right,
do the,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
With the exception of one or two of them, just to kind of rub up against.
Right.
Number six, hyperbole. This is more of a literary one in some ways, even though there is versions of this in the cinematic. Exaggeration to absurd extremes.
For reference, the Onion example is: magnanimous boss, king of kings, allows employees to watch World Cup in his office. Okay.
Right.
Bob, this is where I put to the pain, like to the extreme, because it's like. It's like 10 sentences of describing
okay.
the torture,
I
you know, like absurd extreme. It just keeps going and going and going and going.
I would also say maybe rats being enormous or something
yeah,
like that. Is
that's
that
good.
Absurd?
Yeah.
That
is, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is harder than it looks doing this stuff.
No, but I love that we're finding examples
yeah.
of in everything and sometimes multiples.
You could even say some of the stuff with Fezzik, how enormous he is portrayed
to the extreme,
and the feats that he is capable of.
Yes,
him climbing that rope is inhuman, right?
Right.
Yeah, and I think part of this is because this movie isn't comedy with a capital K. Like Wayne's World is literally comedy.
It's 100% comedy,
and,
right?
And if we did Airplane or something like that, I'm sure these would be nothing to find. But,
right.
but
right.
because this movie does kind of have its own seriousness. I think that's why it's more like you could probably find a million character jokes in mm-hmm. this. And that's kind of some of the laughs, but some of mm-hmm. the other more nuanced ones might not play as
right.
much or less nuanced ones actually. Okay. So wordplay, puns, rhymes, double entendres, et cetera.
There's multiples. What was the one you used, Jamie, that you were talking about?
A couple of the ones, these almost would list as double entendres, not necessarily sexual, but in the other, in just kind of more mundane way. But I have, let's kill each other like civilized people.
Yeah.
He says something like that. And then a few more steps and we'll be safe in the fire swamp. There's a lot of those that are just like.
The alliteration.
There's literally an ongoing rhyming joke.
That's the one I was going to, yeah. The rhyme
that's
joke.
True.
The
yeah.
rhyming joke.
No right. more rhymes now. I mean it. Anybody want a peanut?
Peanut?
Yeah.
Right. That's a good one.
I mean, that's one of the yeah. big jokes in the movie. Yeah.
Okay. So eight, analogy, comparing two disparate things. What's the example of that they gave? And I'm sure it's very literary.
I'll let Bob think for a minute before I go.
No,
I
no, no.
Something.
Give us the example of that of what they said.
Oh,
it is.
Oh
yeah. Do you
oh,
have the
man,
example?
I don't think it's a great example, but man approaches yeah. unfamiliar shower knob like he's breaking a wild stallion.
Okay.
He's breaking a wild stallion.
It's very, very literary. Hard to see that outside of dialogue in the actual movie.
Yeah.
Man, that's yeah.
I got two, but Bob, keep thinking.
No,
for a
go
minute.
Ahead.
Okay.
I didn't come up with anything.
The first
that.
One is Vizzini to Fezzik. He says, "You weren't hired for your brains, you hippopotamic landmass." So that is, you know, comparing two completely different analogies. And I use Jamie. I put the wordplay thing you just did, the double entendre, in this category. You put down your rock, I put down my sword, and we'll try to kill each other like civilized people. Like, kill each other like civilized people is a great, weird analogy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would never go against a Sicilian when death is on the line? Like,
probably,
it doesn't...
Yeah, those...
What
yeah,
does those two things
is,
have to do
yeah,
with each other? Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. So, yeah.
Okay. Madcap, crazy, wacky, silly, nonsensical.
There's tons of this.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, the fire swamp.
That's crazy, wacky, right?
Even to the rodents. Him rolling down the hill.
The hill rolling was the first thing that came to mind. That's goofy.
The fight between Wesley and Fezzik, I think, is silly.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like, so, yeah. You know, there's three right there off the top of our heads that come in this category.
Their fake attack with Dread Pirate Roberts as the giant wooden thing on fire. Like, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, number 10, meta humor, jokes about jokes, so about the idea of comedy. And I think this could be about fantasy or storytelling as well for what we're talking about. I don't think it has to be jokes about comedy. The one I put that I feel is kind of meta, I feel like all these stuff with Fred Savage and stuff could almost be that way.
All of it is meta. Yeah.
But the other one I just circled was kind of the pit of despair. Because it's kind of making fun of what it is.
Absolutely. No, and I thought
when we were talking earlier, that's why I said I think that joke defines the movie.
Yeah.
It feels like a very Mel Brooks joke, too.
It does. It really does.
It does. Jamie, I put exactly what you said. Like, is this going to be a kissing book? Oh, they're kissing again. I mean, that's meta. Yeah. Like, they're commenting on the movie. So, definitely.
Okay. And last but not least, misplaced focus. Attention is focused on the wrong thing. I have one for this. So for me, this is the one where Buttercup says, because you've always been so kind to me, I'll be seeing you again since I'm killing myself once we reach the honeymoon. And the king says, wouldn't that be nice? He kissed me. Yeah.
Right. That's the example I use too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
I almost want to say the marriage thing is for the audience almost the wrong thing, because he comes out of nowhere, almost says that's not even a character joke. It's just like, almost a gag joke in this movie that kind of is out of place with some of the other types of comedy.
Focusing on his pronunciation, you mean?
Yeah, like it's kind of got, it's one of the jokes where it kind of comes out of nowhere.
That's good.
You know, I'm kind of surprised Bob has never been asked to give that speech at a wedding at some point.
Me too.
That's the most shocking part of this whole thing.
I've given several wedding speeches.
Yes,
so
that's
I'm
why.
Waiting. I'm waiting for that one. We'll see.
It seems like an obvious.
I didn't
officiate though to do that one.
I would. Yeah, I've never officiated a wedding.
Okay, that's why.
I didn't put this on the actual talking points, but I added I added two bonus to this list, which is sarcasm and sight gags. Can you guys think of some sarcasm off the top of your head?
Man, I feel like Wesley has so many sarcastic moments, especially after he's half dead, when he's like trying to recover.
Yeah.
Jamie. Yeah,
it's just
putting us on the spot, man.
I love it. The listeners out there are yelling things.
I know, but when you're put on the spot while you're recording, it's like
sight gag. I immediately went to like Andre, like when he bonks the guy in the head, like
absolutely. That
there's so many sight
hanging
gags.
Wesley off of the knight armor. I always think of that, and Carrie always is just hanging there.
There's so many sight gags. The fireplace bellow, Miracle Max putting the fireplace bellow in Wesley's mouth to pump air in him is like really silly. Like there's so many.
It's funny, like for sarcasm, I'm getting a vibe. Like one of my favorite movies that nobody talks about as a kid was Bronco Billy. Did you ever see Bronco Billy?
Never seen it.
But there's this classic line where he's like saying that I will throw the knife. It's blah blah blah, and Sandra Locke's like tied to the thing, and he's doing target practice like as part of the show, and she's like, "Must you, Bronco Billy?" And it's like kind of a classic line if you've ever seen it, because she's so could care less, you know.
Yeah, gotcha.
But I'm thinking this is a long way of saying I'm thinking there must be a line like that in this movie, like somebody says something very earnest, and then somebody responds in a way that's very like. You know, they say the thing they're supposed to say, but the the context behind it is completely the opposite, but I can't think what that is.
There's one with the kid and the grandpa where he's like, isn't that a wonderful beginning? And the kid says, yeah, it's great, grandpa. You know, so that's, to your point, there's one example of that.
Character based too.
Right. And grandpa says, your vote of confidence is overwhelming. So there's two sarcasm right there. Between one's the kid being sarcastic and the other's the grandpa being sarcastic. So, yeah, but I was really glad that we were able. So there you go. 13 different types of jokes. We just ran through, and for most of them, we found two or three of each. So if you're writing
Jamie like off the top of our head,
yeah,
right? Like
I cheated. I went through and
I'm glad you did. So you fill in when we were drawing a
that
blank.
Was the goal. I like this. This is only the second time we've done this. I like this segment because I think it's really instructive that like comedy comes in many forms, and
it's something I think a lot of people don't think about. I also think that there is probably a list out there for types of violence or action that like, you know, when it comes to that kind of stuff too. So stuff like this works for me. Like, if you have everything be the same all the time, it's very
boring. Right. Cause it's like, we've talked, you know, every time we do a horror episode, we talk about the types of horror. This is the same. It's just a bigger list.
Right. but I think that goes right into, like, we almost already a little bit mentioned it. Dialogue repetition, which is with this movie, it's huge.
It's why I think it's like it lives on forever just because of this technique alone, right?
Like, literally, there's three statements I could think right off the top of my head. They're iconic, right? As you wish, inconceivable, and my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father, prepared to die, right? Like, those three things right there are immortal movie quotes.
That's almost as iconic as May the Force Be With You.
Yeah, like literally. It's like, yeah, anyone says inconceivable, one word, inconceivable, for the rest of time will make most people of the Western world think of this movie. That is an incredible bit of storytelling to create that.
I don't even think I can say that word without doing a little imitation.
While Sean, right.
It just feels wrong.
Yeah. And or somebody says it and you kind of be like, this word, you think it means what I don't think it means. You know, like you want to like respond to him as you would in the movie.
But to get to the how of this real quick.
Right.
So,
yeah. Sorry.
No. I knew that if I put it on there, you'd be able to speak to it, and I wouldn't have to say a damn thing. So there's a technique here, which is typically, and with Inigo Montoya, we do get like a rule of three with it, but that third time he says it like five times in a row, so it feels like he's saying it 10 times, but it's really just like three big ones.
No, that counts as one.
As one. I'm sure there's more than three when it comes to Inigo, but the easiest way to pull this off is you do a dialogue setup, just like you've talked about in the past, Bob. It functions like a joke.
Right.
You repeat it, right?
Establish.
You establish the pattern, and then you have a third occasion where the dialogue comes up, and that's the payoff. That's the reversal. That's the punchline. Usually that shows that payoff reversal shows character or relationship growth. You know, it's the moment where Luke uses the, you know, it's the in May the Force Be With You, Han Solo is the one who says it the third time, and he's the one who's been shown to not believe in these things the whole movie, and he's the one who says it. You know, there's so many examples. Recent ones are in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. It's a leap of faith, you know, like it's said multiple times, and then the third time it's Miles saying it. We don't trade lives in Infinity War. It's Captain America saying it twice, and then the third time Vision says it to Captain America.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So, and As You Wish is like my favorite one because it's said by the storyteller himself, the one who, you know, and it shows you like what the movie's all about. It's all building, like you said, Bob, to him being the one to say it.
Grandson.
Yeah.
Right.
It repeating it imbues it with meaning that it didn't have before and makes it special. So this is a great example of using dialogue repetition, and that's one of the reasons why all the lines
it's
are
a
so
response
iconic.
To like a human to like you know, an innate human trait, which is if we hear things many times,
yes,
they stick with you and have meaning. We build meaning on things we see and hear often. So,
right. Yeah. So
there's kind of another like lesser version of this, which is just a simple setup callback kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't know if you picture him saying inconceivable. And then when he's dying, he's like, you know, I can't believe you tricked me. And if Wesley said inconceivable, or, you know what I mean? It's
like, yeah, you could do that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right.
I find I do that one a lot.
Me too. I do that too. Yeah.
Oh, it's almost like with Robert Downey Jr.'s death, right? In Endgame too.
When mm-hmm. he's
repeating what Thanos said.
Yep.
Toys. We were talking about toys, right?
Okay.
Is toyetic a real word?
Jamie's the one who introduced me to the word toyetic.
Is that a real word?
Yeah. And I can't remember where I picked it up, but it's definitely something that people get like in meetings, like, oh, that's a very toyetic character.
That's why I put it on there. Yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of like one of those terms that is kind of gross. Like people usually, when they talk about their horror stories of going into a studio meeting,
eye rolling.
When the word toyetic comes up, it's like, really?
Boy.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've talked about this in the past. Jimmy, I feel like this is one you often bring up, is creating toyetic characters, right?
Yeah. So I figured it's been 8 months. Jurassic Park is the last time we did this. So it's been 8 months.
Yell at us.
They're doing the same thing. I don't want to, you know, do it too often. But now,
I should also say Jimmy's not doing it because he thinks you should write movies that make toys. Like he does this for dramas and other things that will never sniff a toy, most likely.
Jimmy's house is just filled with toys, actually. No, that's all it is.
I wish. I love them. But no, I almost did this for the menu episode because I feel like all of those characters are toyetic and like we could do a great action figure exercise for each of those characters in the menu. Accessory would be their.
This is a fantasy movie, though.
So this is an exercise. I call it the action figure exercise. This is an exercise that I created for my clients because I'm a script consultant. I read scripts all day from people who are just learning the craft. Most people that come to me are new. A person like Jamie wouldn't need to come to me, a professional with an agent and a manager. They have their own note systems. But I am often working with people who are just starting out or they're like three scripts in, right? So they're honing their craft. But one of the most common problems I have in scripts is I will read a script that is so focused on the inner qualities of a character and getting to the heart of who a person is but they are so scared of offending potential producers or cast members,
costume designers,
anything that they literally will not describe what the character looks like in any way, shape, or form. And so I will read scripts, and I'm telling you, I've read at least 200 scripts like this. I'm not exaggerating. Where not a single character has described the visual qualities of the iconography of the character itself. Like imagine reading Star Wars, and Darth Vader is just described as like an evil person driven by the dark side of the force, right? And that's it. Like you don't describe him as 7 feet tall or his costume or what he sounds like.
For just as much how he looks as how he is.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of opinions out there that you shouldn't describe your character because you're potentially discriminating against future casting. And I see the value in that, represententation is super important. But when it comes to like telling a story, what the character looks like their physique, their costume is crucial. Like you can't read a script. And if I get to the end of your script and I couldn't tell you what any of the characters look like, you failed. You did not do your job. And
I think that's something that most people would never assume.
What?
Most like beginners would never assume that you should know how characters look. I think that's No, that's what I'm saying. This is a good thing to talk about.
Yeah, like for me, like when I'm creating a character, what they look like is like a huge part of the brainstorming process. So this is
I mean that people don't consider that writing.
Gotcha.
But it is right.
So, there's, you know, there is truth to, like, the costume designer is going to do whatever the hell they want, right? But it's your job to describe the costume that they're going to then take their own artistic liberties with, right? The casting director and the director are going to do whatever they want and hire whatever actor they want to play your character. But it's still your job to visually represent them on the page in a way that informs who they might cast for the story. So I have a very simple set of whiteboard prompts, and these are all designed to visually get to the heart of who your character is. And often these prompts can inspire other parts of the movie, right? As you're doing this, like, think about, so I'll go down the little prompts and then we can, like, go and do this for a couple characters.
Sure.
So before we start the characters, I'll just describe all the prompts. So, their unique physique, and this is less about attractiveness and more about their physique. Like I said, like, imagine describing Fezzik and not putting that he's a giant on the page, right? Right. Like, describing his physique is crucial to cementing the character in the reader's head. And it's really important to the story and how he physically is in physical contrast to the other characters in the story. Like, describing his physique is a you must, right? But I'll read scripts that won't do that. Like, when we talked about the Raiders of the Lost Ark episode, imagine in Raiders of the Lost Ark when he's fighting the Nazi on the wing actions thing, and that guy's like a 7 foot tall Nazi soldier, and Indiana Jones is an everyman. Well, imagine you never described that Indiana Jones has an everyman physique, and that this guy wasn't you never described that he was fighting a 7 foot tall Nazi soldier, right? You just said he was fighting a soldier, right? It seems simple, but you'd be shocked. People do not describe what the characters look like. So anyway, unique physical appearance. This can include hairstyles, things like that, physique. Costume. I basically ask, what clothes are in your character's closet during the course of the movie? And this is where, for an action hero and for an action figure standpoint, this is where you get the alt figures, right? You have indie figure one, you have where he's in his standard costume, then he's in a Nazi costume, then he's in another costume, and Luke Skywalker has like five different alt costumes during the course of Star Wars. You know, he's got his wet from the trash compactor costume. That's one figure. So think about, like, what clothes are in your character's
Star
costume.
Wars is like where this feels like, yeah, it comes from, pretty absolutely much, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Accessories. What thing best represents your character? That's what's going to go in their action figure package, right? They're going to come with an accessory.
You're going to have a lightsaber, right?
You're going to have a lightsaber, right? You're going to have a whip. You're going to have something that's important to the story and represents the premise and the character. So think about what thing that might be in your action figure box. Brainstorming all that will create scenarios, right? We'll create more ideas. Scars, birthmarks, or tattoos specific to your character and the premise.
Or like crutches or something, even that. You know
what
I mean?
Yeah, that's
like
just
that.
As good. Like a like a limp.
Cast.
A cast, that's
even
good.
Even a wheelchair, maybe? Like,
yeah, that like could inform whether that happens before the story starts or during the movie. You know, those things are important. And that's going to help you come up with impactful moments, you know, just from that. Or impactful character history, thinking about that. And then this is the last one. Pull string quotes or catchphrases. If your action figure had a button or a pull string, what are like one or two lines
that would be with you?
Right. That could encapsulate the character. That's so,
as you wish.
Yeah.
As you and challenging yourself to figure out what that is, what those pull string quotes are, what those catchphrases are, is going to instantly make your character more memorable and help you hone in on who that character is. So let's do three characters from The Princess Bride and we can bounce off of each other. Vizini, he's my favorite because he's not an action hero, right? Like,
right,
to show that this works for all characters, not just your action heroes. Yeah.
He's unique physical appearance, small, short, bald.
Mm-hmm. You know, he's got the tufts of hair on the side. That's right. An iconic look.
Right. Yeah. Small, he's a small man compared to everyone in the movie.
Right. That's important, right? That
he's,
informs
he's got
his
a little
character.
Bit of a Napoleon complex.
Yes. That's right. That's perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about his costume?
He's sort of. His costume's a little bit hard to describe, but I was thinking maybe it's like a
poet shirt.
he's like, yeah, like a Shakespearean court jester.
Yeah, it's like a green. It's green
it's got
and
the
velvet.
Puffy, a little
puffy.
Bit to it.
I think the exaggerated
puffy shirt.
Sleeves are really important,
puffy
right?
Shirt,
that
yeah.
This small yeah. man with exaggerated huge shoulder pads is very comical looking.
Right, because
and you can
to feel
totally
right.
Right, and you can totally write that. Like he looks like he's wearing football shoulder pads underneath the tunic to bulk him. Himself up. Accessories. What accessory would come in his package? In his action figure package?
Maybe give him a cup.
Yeah, the black chalices the Battle of Wits. And to your point, Bob, like
a dagger too.
Yeah, a dagger.
Yeah.
There is a McFarlane Toys Princess Bride line and Vizzini comes with two black
chalices.
Oh, really?
I didn't actually look. I didn't click the link you sent us, so I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Prior. Okay, that's awesome.
Pull string quotes or catchphrases.
I mean,
inconceivable.
Yeah. Inconceivable. Fezzik. Fezzik's the hardest one here because Inigo Montoya is obviously, "You killed my father. Prepare to die."
Mm-hmm.
But Fezzik. You anybody want a peanut?
Anybody want a peanut? I am on the brute squad.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah. Right.
But with Fezzik, like Fezzik's another good one because he would have an alt figure too. And the Mark McFarlane Toys does have the alt figure with the big black cloak.
Oh, really?
Whereas they sell
Dread Pirate.
Yeah,
Robert Spezza.
Yeah,
yeah.
So yeah, and I think Inigo. If we go down the whole thing,
I'd give Fezzik a rock.
Yeah, you give Fezzik.
Oh,
Fezzik's accessory would be the
rock.
Yeah,
a rock.
And the McFarlane Toys does come with the boulder.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool.
So that's great.
Hey, they should call us. We should work.
We should. We got this.
Inigo. Let's go down the list for Inigo because I think like doing the whole
Inigo,
thing for Inigo is
physical
good.
Appearance. He's athletic.
Mm-hmm. Handsome. Mm-hmm. Rugged.
Handsome, athletic. Yeah.
He's got an everyman physique.
Dashing. He's dashing.
Dashing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Long dark hair and mustache.
He gets a rapier as a rapier, toy.
Yep, he's got his father's sword, and he's got scars. What are his scars?
Oh, well, his scars on the cheeks.
He's got scars from the six-fingered man, there would be an alt figure, which again the McFarlane confirmed with the McFarlane Toys that there is an alt figure Inigo Montoya where he's all covered with blood with all the stab wounds
that's
from
awesome.
The fight. So you know there's an alt. Yeah,
I was gonna say for costume, this is less defined, I think, for Inigo, but it's almost like he's like a little bit pauperish.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's obviously poor.
Mm-hmm.
But he was he's like a warrior, but he's a poor warrior. Like
he's a poor warrior. I like that.
He's a pauper of some sort.
And
accessories, sword. I mean
sword. Yeah. Yeah. And you already said his pull string quote earlier, "My name is Inigo, you kill my prepare to die."
I mean,
that's
how can
obviously
it not be that?
You could also give him, "I'm not left-handed."
Yeah. And that would also cat that whole gag.
"I want my father back, you son of a bitch."
"I want my father back, you son of a bitch." Yeah, no, that would be good. But anyway, these simple things, I think every writer should take the time to figure these things out. You know, I, of course, there's always value in the flow, right? You want to, getting into the flow is like the hardest part of just like sitting down and flowing writing. And sometimes these things have a tendency to keep you from the flow, but I think it's valuable to figure out what your character looks like and what would make them visually iconic, even if it's just a drama, right? Like this isn't a drama example, but, Ned Ryerson in Groundhog Day, right? Like he's got a trench coat and a briefcase and you know,
he's bald
head.
With a hat. Yeah.
Yeah, bald with the hat. He's like, he's an icon. He's got pull string quotes. Watch that first step. It's a doozy.
Right. You're
you
right.
Know, like Ned Ryerson, you could do the action figure exercise. Think of any great character, whether it's an action hero or not. And I bet you could do the action figure exercise and all of this stuff would be easy to describe and would inform why they're so visually why they're just so memorable.
I would say one thing about this is, like, you know how there's like this rash of like small indie companies that make action figures for characters you never would have assumed that they would exist. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that's sort of funny and sort of like a little bit cynical is because those characters are not really toyetic in any way. Like, they're not, that's why they never got an action figure, but people online are like, hey, here's an action figure of Tom Hanks from, you know, I don't know, Sleepless in Seattle, right? And it has a backboard and it has like stuff on the back, the character descriptions. That's the joke. It's like the reverse of this. Like, it doesn't have this exercise for it. And the internet's inherent cynical humor is making fun of how
is identifying that they
that
didn't
this
do
doesn't
this. Yeah.
work for this, but it's funny that there would be a toy of this guy. So, like, yeah, that's like, I'm just saying there's like actually a reversal of this because it works so well for some stuff that you can make a joke about how it doesn't work for some characters, you know?
Yeah. But yeah, so that's it, right?
That's great. Yeah. No, yeah, that's it. I think that brings us to the end here. Do you guys have anything you want to point people towards? I always ask just in case. Jamie, I know there's Jamie. Always get Jamie's books. They're on Amazon, right?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything new or exciting right now. So besides the books, just the books. And follow me at Jamie_Nash on Twitter.
Cool. Jimmy?
Nothing to plug right now. Nothing to plug.
I'm going to thank everybody who is supporting me on Patreon. You're directly supporting this show and you're keeping it ad free and you're giving me the ability to, I don't know. I've been doing it for 5 years on my dime. So I appreciate everybody. I'm not going to list everybody right now because I don't have it up. I forgot, but thank you to everyone who is currently supporting that. I appreciate it. With that, I think we're done, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Inconceivable, right?
Inconceivable. We finished it.
We finished it. Yeah.
It's a callback.
Right. It's a callback. And
dialogue repetition.
Let's call back to the original opening and just say we're all very old and thank you for listening to us.
Yeah. we're doing a show on a dying art form.
On a dying art form about a movie that is that's from the 80s. So thank you for listening.
Errol's Video sponsored today's program.
Jamie, there is literally, I've seen Errol's Video shirts that's like a thing I've seen on sale on the internet several times. So, gonna have to get Jamie one for Christmas, you know.
It probably didn't exist back then, but
it
now
probably didn't exist now, right? Yeah. It exists now. Oh, God. The time. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Hey, this is Bob Rose, and thank you for listening to Writer's Blockbusters. If you'd like to financially support the show, please consider joining my Patreon. I've been producing the podcast for several years completely out of pocket, and I'd like to keep producing it ad-free and no longer at a loss. If you'd like to help, head on over to patreon.com/BobRoseSucks. That's right, Bob Rose sucks. And if you want the one and only Jimmy George to help polish up that writing project you're kind of struggling with, head on over to scriptbutcher.com. As a listener, you already know he's the best there is, scriptbutcher.com. You can also support the show by simply sharing it or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate both. Thank you for listening and see you next episode.